Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavanscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ragunatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadhaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurange Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vanchakopatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Ebacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare So this verse is in the 8th chapter of First Canto. Viparashantu tat sarasvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhagavato darshanam yat syad apunar bhava darshanam vipadashantu tasashvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam yad syad apunar bhava darshanam. And the translation. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. So the verse that preceded this verse, Vishan Mahagne Purushad Darshanad Asat Sabhaya Vanavasha Krishtrataha Mridhe Mridhe Neka Mahar Ratastrato Darunya Stratas Chasmahare Birakshita. My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poisoned cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from a vicious assembly, from sufferings due during our exile in the forest and from the battle where great generals fought. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashvatthama. So this is chapter 8 in Srimad Bhagavatam. And chapter 8 is called The Prayers by Queen Kunti. The setting is that Krishna is getting ready to leave. He's been with the Pandavas through the Battle of Kurukshetra, and he's visited them even before the Battle of Kurukshetra. And Kunti Devi, she is describing all the various ways in which Krishna had protected them. That was the previous verse, this verse about your lordship has protected us from a poison cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from a vicious assembly, from sufferings during our exile in the forest and from the battle where great generals fought. And now you have protected us from the weapon of Ashvatthama. So those episodes were part of the episodes of Krishna's protection of the Pandavas. The Pandavas had been put in a difficulty on numerous occasions. And we sometimes wonder why it is that the Supreme Lord puts devotees into difficulties. But he does it so they take full shelter of him. And they become more and more focused on him with greater intensity, because there is never the feeling of brightness that comes after a dark night. You know, when the sun rises and there's been a very dark night, there's never a similar feeling of warmth that comes when finally summer comes or spring comes after a very cold winter. So that those two examples are used. So similarly, when the Supreme Lord wants to intensify the focus and emotion of the devotee, he puts the devotee into some kinds of apparent difficulty. And then when the devotee takes shelter, realizing the Lord is the only place that he can get shelter, then the Lord has succeeded in bringing the devotee to a higher level of attachment and focus. So this is one of the reasons. Of course, there are other reasons why the Supreme Lord puts devotees into difficulty. Everybody is put into difficulty in this material world. So this material world is called Kunta, and the spiritual world is called Vaikunta. Kunta means difficulty. So spiritual world, no difficulties, Vaikunta. This material world is called Kunta, so it's got all difficulties. Difficulties are just a concomitant factor of the way the material world is designed. It's designed to give us all kinds of difficulties. And of course, some of those become very intense. And the Pandavas went through very many intense episodes. Kunti Devi talks about the poison cake, when Duryodhan tried to poison Bhimasen by feeding him a poison cake. Bhimasen ate the poison cake, and then they threw his body in the river. And as he was sinking down in the water, some nagas or snakes came up and bit Bhimasena, but this poison in the snakes counteracted the poison in the cake. And so it woke him up. And when that happened, he began to fight the snakes. And eventually, he makes friends with the snakes. But that was one way where Krishna protected Bhimsen. Then when the Pandavas were in the forest, well, actually a great fire, then Duryodhan again trying to eliminate the Pandavas, he built an assembly in a place called Varnavata. And there in Varnavata, the Pandavas were given a residence that had been designed specifically by Purochana, who was one of Duryodhan's henchmen. And Purochan had built a house that was made entirely of flammable lac or some kind of varnish that was intended to actually be quite flammable. And the notion was that the Pandavas would stay there and then Purochana would set fire to the house and they would die within the house. So before Purochana could actually do that, the Pandavas themselves actually set fire to the house, and Purochana died in the house, not the Pandavas. But they had an excavator sent to them by their uncle, Vidur, who understood that there was some danger and some plot against them. So this digger came to the Pandavas' home in Varnavata, and he dug an escape tunnel underneath the house out. And so they went through the tunnel and they were saved. And then while they were in the forest, before they were, as far as I remember, I think it was before they were exiled. There was two times they were in the forest. One was after this episode with the house at Varnavata. They ran onto a couple of cannibals, Hidimba and Hidimbi. They were brother and sister. And these Rakshasas, Hidimba, had smelled that the Pandavas had come into his area, so he immediately wanted to eat them. And he sent his sister to scout out what was happening. So when Hidimbi came, she saw the Pandavas, and she immediately fell in love with Bhimasena. And so she thought, well, if my brother eats Bhimasena, he'll have one meal, so big deal. But if I marry him, then I'll be able to have a whole life of joy. So I think I should forget about what my brother wants to do. So she decided to try to save Bhimasena. And she transformed herself into a very attractive lady. And, you know, Bhimasena was watching over the others who were sleeping. And she came to him and she said, "My dear stranger, where have you all come from? Do you not know that this forest is inhabited by very powerful Rakshasas?" And Bhima said, "Well, maybe it is, but what is that to me, you know?" And she said, "Well, my brother is a powerful Rakshasa, and he will be coming soon to eat you. You should leave immediately." And Bhima said, "Well, you know, everybody's sleeping. I don't see any reason to disturb them." And she said, no, my brother is coming and he will attack you." And he said, "I'm not interested in whether your brother attacks or not. I have no fear from your brother." And so then her brother did arrive. Her brother Hidimba arrived, and Hidimba immediately saw his sister with Bhimasena. He could understand, because she had taken a beautiful form, immediately what was happening. Then instead of coming back to tell him about their meal, that she'd become attracted to Bhimasena. And he said, "My dear sister, I see what you are up to here, that you are trying to have a romantic relationship with my lunch, and I think that this is not proper. You are a disgrace to our family." And stand aside. And then he tried to push his sister out of the way, and Bhimasena said, "You can't do that." And the Rakshasa said, "Who are you? You're just a human, and I'm a Rakshasa. You will soon be my lunch, so don't give me so much trouble." And Bhima said, well, if you dare to fight with me, then you will soon understand that I am not your lunch. And so Bhimasena, he grabbed Hidimba and he dragged him, you know, quite a distance away from where everybody was sleeping, because Bhimasena could understand that a fight was about to happen. He didn't want to wake everybody up, so he dragged them away. So this Rakshasa had thought that, you know, he would make quick work of Bhimasena and then devour the Pandavas. But here, he is helplessly being dragged away from the proximity of the sleeping Pandavas. And there in the forest, they begin to fight. Of course, the fight is loud enough that it does wake them all up. And the two are fighting, and you know, this Rakshasa is becoming immediately aware that Bhimasena is no average mortal human, that he's very powerful, and he's having trouble with Bhimasena. And of course, the Pandavas wake up, and Arjuna and the others come to see the fight taking place. And Arjuna, you know, he's watching the fight for a while, and he says, "Oh, it looks, Bhima, you're getting a little tired. Just stand aside, and I will shoot this Rakshasa with my arrows. So do not worry any further." And this was actually calculated by Arjuna, because he knew how this would affect Bhimasena. He knew that Bhimasena would not tolerate the idea of having anybody help him in finishing off this Rakshasa. So he became immediately very angry, and he grabbed Hidimba and smashed him against a sal tree again and again and again until his back was broken. He was no longer living, and which was what Arjuna wanted. You know, he didn't want Bhimasena to tarry with him very long. He just wanted to finish him off. So that's what Bhimasena did at that time. And then, of course, when Hidimba was killed, Hidimbi went immediately to Kunti, who was also watching the fight. She was with them in the forest. And she said, "My dear Kunti, you know what it's like to be a woman, and you can understand that I have been attracted by your son. Please arrange somehow or another that I can be married to him." And so it was to be that Bhimasena would marry Hidimbi, and they would have a son, Ghatakacha, and so on and so forth. But in this way, the Supreme Lord protected them from cannibals, from a vicious assembly. That's, of course, the assembly where Krishna supplies an unlimited sari to Draupadi when she's being mocked and insulted in the assembly of the Kauravas during the gambling match where Yudhishthira has gambled away the kingdom that they had, their kingdom at Indraprastha. And he's gambled away the freedom of the Pandavas. And then he's gambled away Draupadi. So Dushasana has dragged Draupadi from her chambers to the assembly. And he's tried to disrobe her, but of course Krishna supplies an unlimited sari. And in this way, Draupadi is protected. Then, of course, although at that point Dhritarashtra sees that his sons have gone too far, and so he offers to give Draupadi any kind of concession, and she asks for the freedom of her husbands, and then she asks for the restoration of their kingdom, so their kingdom is restored and the husbands are freed. But Duryodhan is shocked by his father's actions, and he calls for a second gambling match. And in that gambling match, the wager is that whoever wins has to go into the forest, and whoever loses has to go in the forest for 13 years, actually 12 years, and the 13th year has to be in incognito. And if someone's discovered in the 13th year, then they have to go in the forest for another 12 years. So that was the stipulations of the second gambling match. In the second gambling match, of course, they also lose. And they're destined to go into the forest for all that time. So now that they're in exile, they face many challenges while they're in the forest. They get challenged by Gandharvas and by Duryodhan tries to get rid of them in the forest and so on and so forth. So in that way, Krishna is protecting them in the forest. One time Duryodhan sends all the disciples of Durvasa Muni with the understanding that Durvasa Muni is very easily angered. So Duryodhan understands that Yudhisthira has a special pot where the pot, when something is cooked in it, provides an unlimited supply of food. Be nice to have one of those, but I don't think Kmart offers that at this point, or Costco or any of those stores. So it was a special pot given that whatever small amount of food is cooked in it, it just keeps going out and out and out and out. Until, of course, Draupadi eats, and then when Draupadi eats, then the pot shuts down. And so Duryodhan was very careful to know when Draupadi had eaten so the pot would no longer have anything in it. And he sent Durvasa Muni's assembly into the area of the Pandavas, knowing that Durvasa Muni and his 60,000 disciples would need to be properly received by the Pandavas, and they would be unable to do that because the pot was no longer distributing unlimited food. So as a result, Durvasa Muni would curse the Pandavas. That was Duryodhan's plan. But it didn't work because when Duryodhan's plan was put into action and Durvasa Muni was coming for the prasadam of the Pandavas, they had to go take bath first in the river. So all of 60,000 disciples of Durvasa Muni were taking bath in the river. And the Pandavas were thinking, oh, we don't have anything to serve them, so we will be certainly cursed by him. And at that time, Krishna arrived. And Krishna said, oh, do you all have anything to eat? And they said, well, that's the problem, that Draupadi has just eaten now, and we have no food. And Durvasa Muni's whole entourage is soon to come, and we have to serve them. We have no way to serve them, so certainly we will be cursed. And Krishna said, are you sure that there's nothing left in the pot? So Draupadi went and looked at the pot, and there was just some small bit of prasadam left. And then when Krishna ate the small bit of prasadam, he said, now, because I've taken prasadam, I feel very satisfied. And since Krishna is the actual source of satisfaction, when he felt satisfied, all of Durvasa Muni's associates and Durvasa Muni felt themselves satisfied. And they felt, if we feel so full right now and we go eat with the Pandavas, we don't eat anything, they're going to be insulted. It will be a great embarrassment for us. And so Krishna sent Bhimasena. He said, go tell them that the prasadam is ready. And Bhima said, but we don't have anything. And Krishna said, just tell them the prasadam is ready. So Bhimasena went with a big drum beating, saying, come, come, prasadam is ready. And they all disappeared because they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to eat anything. And so in this way, Krishna saved them from being cursed by Durvasa Muni. And of course, then Krishna saved them during the Battle of Kurukshetra. And this particular section, the eighth chapter of first canto, it winds up the story of Ashvatthama and how he had murdered the remaining people in the Pandava army after the Battle of Kurukshetra was actually over. Duryodhan had lost. He'd been beaten. beaten by the mace of Bhim Sen, and he was dying on the battlefield. And the war was technically over, but Ashwatthama, being angered that his father had been killed in the battle, he went to the Pandavas' camp and murdered everybody in the Pandavas' camp who were still asleep after the battle, thinking that, of course, the battle was over, so they had nothing to fear at that point. And, of course, he murdered the sleeping sons of the Pandavas, the children that the Pandavas had had by Draupadi. So the Pandavas were not there at that time. They were at the Oggavati River. They were some distance away. And when they heard that Ashwatthama had killed everybody in their encampment, including their children, they ran to arrest Ashwatthama. And as Ashwatthama was being captured, he let loose a Brahmastra, a weapon to kill the Pandavas, and also a weapon to kill the one remaining child that they had, who was Pariksit, who was in the womb of Uttara. He was the only remaining heir of the Pandavas. So Krishna had Arjuna counteract the weapon. There's more to the story, but I don't want to get far away from what I actually want to talk about today. And in this way, the Pandavas were saved from this Brahmastra of Ashwatthama. So Kunti here, the mother of at least three of the Pandavas, she is recounting these various episodes where Krishna has saved them from calamities. And Prabhupada tells us that Kunti was more fortunate than Devaki, because Krishna saved Devaki in one particular episode. And Krishna didn't save all of her children, but he did save all of Kunti's children. So Devaki, her six children prior to Krishna himself, they were all lost to Kamsa's murderous hands. But Kunti, her children were all protected. Even at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, none of her children were harmed by the Battle of Kurukshetra. But she was given this special protection. And the other thing is that Devaki and Vasudeva, they only had one episode in which they were in danger, and that was when Devaki was threatened by Kamsa, and Kamsa killed all of her children successively. And then after that, there was no danger. So this actually shows that Krishna was more merciful. And Prabhupada tells us in the purports that the reason that Krishna was more merciful to Kunti was that Kunti was a widow. Devaki had her husband. Devaki and Vasudeva were together. But, of course, Kunti was widowed because Pandu died early. He was cursed that if he approached his wives for sex, that he would die immediately. There was a whole story about Pandu hunting in the forest and shooting two deer. And those two deer actually were not deer, but they were a sage and his wife who had taken deer form. And so the sage said, just as you've shot me when I was trying to enjoy with my wife in a deer form, then you will also die if you try to enjoy with your wife. So this curse was transferred to Pandu. And when Pandu attempted to enjoy Madri, he fell dead. And so that left both Madri and Kunti widowed. Madri, they decided between the two, would enter the funeral pyre with her husband. But Kunti did not, so that she could tend the children. That was her duty because now they had no father, but it wouldn't be fitting that they would have no mother either. So she was decided to stay behind, and Madri entered the pyre with her husband. And so Krishna had protected the Pandavas, and they faced calamity after calamity, and that's why this verse. Vipad santu tat sashvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam yad syad apunar bhava darshanam. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. So Kunti is stating that she would rather be beset with material adversities, even of very extreme types, just so that she could see Krishna, rather than live a somewhat safe and calm life and be bereft of Krishna's association, because she sees that at that point Krishna is preparing to mount his chariot. The battle of Kurukshetra is over. Ashvatthama has been dealt with. They're not in danger. And Krishna's leaving. Krishna's leaving to go back to Dwarka. He has no apparent reason to be with them. And for this reason, Kunti is lamenting. And she's saying she would rather have calamities and Krishna rather than no calamities and no Krishna. So this verse also shows a very unique mentality. And most of us do not favor calamities. Very few people actually have this sense of wanting some kind of adversity. It's natural, it's human nature to want to be safe, to want to be freed from all kinds of disturbances. But we see that in the material world, it's not possible to be free from all kinds of material disturbances, because the material world in and of itself is disturbing. It disturbs us in so many ways. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about this idea that Bhagavad Gita in seventh chapter, we have that there are four kinds of pious persons who approach the Supreme. The Artha, Artharthi, the Jigyasur, and the Jnani. So we have the person who is in distress, the Artha, the Artharthi, the one who is desiring wealth or some kind of facility. The Jigyasur, the inquisitive, and the jnani, the one who is in actual knowledge or one who is looking for knowledge. So these are four kinds of pious people who approach Krishna. They approach Krishna for different reasons, and they are not considered necessarily pure devotees, because a person that approaches Krishna for relief from their suffering or misery, that person is materially motivated. However, it's a good thing, because if you approach Krishna for relief, then at least you know the right person to approach. You're not approaching a demigod, and you're not simply just trying on your own abilities to overcome some calamity. But you're approaching Krishna. So that leads one forward to thinking about Krishna. And we have in the Bhagavatam this verse, akama savakamo va moksha kama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogini yajeda purushamparam, or something like that. I'm not sure I remember the last line. But if one has no material desires, or one has all material desires, still one should tivrena with all great tenacity. Try to serve the Supreme, and in that way we will be delivered from all kinds of things, and we will become purified. So whatever reason one thinks about Krishna, one will be delivered. Yena tena prakarena mana Krishna nivesha yet. That in whatever way one becomes associated with Krishna, then one will become purified by that association. So if one approaches Krishna for distress, if one approaches Krishna for some kind of facility, if one approaches Krishna out of curiosity, if one approaches Krishna even with a negative emotion, like one fears Krishna, or one is envious of Krishna, or one actually dislikes Krishna and constantly thinks about Krishna, still one will be purified by that association. There's also another famous verse. What is it? Gopya kamad bayat kam so. See if I can remember the whole Gopya kamad bayat kam so. Chadyad. What is it? Dveshas chadadio. Dveshas chadyadayo nripaha. Sambandhad Vrishnaya Sneha Yuyam Bhakta Vayam Vibho, I think is how the whole verse goes. Kamsa Bayad, that Kamsa by his fear of Krishna, Gopya Kamad, Gopis by their love of Krishna, Gopya Kamad Bayat Kamsa, that Gopis by their love, Kamsa by his fear, Dvesach Chadya Dio Nripaha. Chadya is a reference to the demoniac personality, Chedi Raj, or in this case, we usually think of him as, what's his name, his other name. He was killed by Krishna in an assembly. When he blasphemed Krishna, he always blasphemed Krishna again.
Shishupal,
right. That's his other name that I couldn't remember. So Chadyadeo or Chedi Raj actually refers to Shishupal. And so by his envy, Dveshas, Chadyadeo, Nripaha, Nripaha here means king. And Sambadhad Vrishnayas, the Vrishnis, by their family relationship to Krishna. Sambandhad Vrishnaya Sneha. Sneha means their love. So Snehad Yuyam. So in this case, the Pandavas, he's talking, I think it's Narada Muni speaking here, and he's speaking to the Pandavas in this verse. And he's saying, you Pandavas, by your Sneha, your love for Krishna, and Snehad Vishna, Snehad Vishnas, Sambandhad Vrishnaya Sneha, Yuyam Bhakta Vayam Vibho, and us, the Brahmanas, by our bhakti, our performance of bhakti, we all become attracted to Krishna. So all these different personalities became purified by their various encounters with Krishna in different manners. So if, like the gopis, you're attracted by Krishna because of your love, the way the gopis are, or you're attracted to Krishna by your fear of Krishna, the way Kamsa was, or you're attracted to Krishna by your envy of Krishna, the way Shishupal was, or you're attracted to Krishna by your family relationship, like the Vrishnis were, or you're attracted to Krishna by your affection, the way the Pandavas were, or you're attracted to Krishna by your performance of bhakti, the way the Narada Muni suggests, then all of these are ways to be purified by Krishna. So certainly we learn that Krishna is something like a tar baby. I don't know, probably you all have never heard that. That's a Western parable of this. It comes from the stories of Brer Wolf or something like that, if I remember right, that there is this effigy or this little straw form of a man made out of tar. And so the straw is there and the tar is on the outside. It's got, it's got, I guess, some kind of clothes on it, so it actually resembles a person. And farmers do this in fields, you know. So Brer Rabbit or whoever it is goes up to the tar baby, and he punches the tar baby. And of course, when he punches him with his hand, his hand becomes stuck to the tar baby, and he says, "Let go of my hand or I will punch you even harder." And he punches with the other hand. His other hand gets stuck. And he says, "I will kick you." And he kicks him with one foot, and that foot gets stuck. So Krishna is something like that. That once you get stuck to Krishna, it's hard to let go, and you just get more and more stuck. And so however you first get stuck to Krishna is how you will be actually eventually fortunate. So four kinds of pious persons come to Krishna, you know, we learn in Bhagavad Gita. And we learn that even if one has a negative attitude towards Krishna, if somehow or other he's attracted by Krishna, then he will be purified, even if it's a negative attitude. Shishupal was purified, Kamsa was purified. And even we find in the Bhagavatam, I forget who it is that's talking in Bhagavatam in this particular section, but he's kind of amazed that the Brahmanas killed King Vena and he goes to hell. But Kamsa was delivered by Krishna and he saw personally the body of Shishupal get ripped apart by Krishna's chakra, and the soul came out of Shishupal's body and entered into Krishna. And the great sages consider, at least those who were interested in impersonal merging, that this facility of merging into the body of Krishna is a great success. So he was asking the natural question, well, why is it that King Vena was sent to hell, but Shishupal, who was also negative towards Krishna, he was delivered instead? So the answer, of course, is this verse, Gopya Kamad Bayakam, so Dvesach Chadya Dio Nripaha. Snehad sambandhad Vrishnaya Sneha Yuyam Bhakta Vayam Vibho, that verse that he says that however one thinks of Krishna, one is delivered. Vena's problem was he didn't think about Krishna in any kind of way. He wasn't attracted to Krishna. He wasn't repulsed by Krishna. He didn't think about Krishna. He was just materialistically motivated. So when he was killed, he got no benefit. If he'd at least hated Krishna, he might have gotten some benefit, but not even. So in this way, Vena was not able to get any kind of benediction, simply went to hell. So these points are there that Krishna uses calamities to bring the devotee closer to the Supreme Lord. He uses calamities to bring the devotee closer to the Supreme Lord. And actually, if we understand that, we look at calamities in a different way. Evidently, Kunti Devi is looking at calamities in a different way. I wish that those calamities would happen again and again, and that we could see you again and again, for seeing you means we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. If one becomes attracted to Krishna, then one will no longer see repeated birth and death. Why do we say that? Because if one becomes actually focused on Krishna in the mind, then quickly one is delivered from the cycle of birth and death. We become purified and we're eligible to re-enter the spiritual world after the life of material suffering is over. And in fact, when one is fully focused on Krishna, then suffering is inconsequential. One does not even pay that much attention. Prabhupada, in the purport of this verse, you know, this is 1.8.25, Prabhupada in the purport of this verse says, sometimes we are in bed asleep and we see a tiger is coming to eat us and we're in terror. But we wake up and realize that there's no tiger. So in a similar way, that the adversities of this world are not real. Of course, we see that the body dies. Even if you're a pure devotee, the body will die. Even if you're a great king, the body will die. Even if you're the most powerful fighter, the body will die. So we already knew that when we took birth. And the fact that we're going to die is not something that might happen. It's something that will happen. It's just a matter of when. So ultimately, the body will have to be given up. So nobody escapes that fate. Not even Brahma, although he lives for 4.11 trillion years. No one escapes the fate of having to leave their body. And therefore, these calamities are of no consequence. Of course, it's said that one should try to protect the body as much as is within their capacity to protect it. But ultimately, there will come some moment where we will not be able to protect the body, and the body will be gone. And if we are thinking of Krishna, then that's the best thing. Then we've succeeded in life. And that's why we say, yena tena prakarena mana Krishna niveshayat, that somehow or other one must always think of Krishna. And also there's that other verse, what is it? I can't draw it to mind right now. It's the verse that translates to always think of Krishna and never forget Krishna. On these two principles, all the Vedic injunctions are actually based. Smartavya satatam Vishnu, or Vishmartavya na jatu chit. Sarvavidhi nisedasyur etyore eva kinkara. That's what the verse is. Smartavya satatam Vishnu. Always think of Krishna. Vishmartavya na jatu chit. Never forget Krishna at any time. Sarvavidhi nisedasyur. All the Vedic literatures. Sarvavidhi nisedasyur etyore eva kinkara. Hang on this two principles, to always think of Krishna, never forget Krishna. So calamities are actually a tool, a force, a method by which we become very much focused on Krishna. And it takes someone at a very high degree of spiritual realization to make a statement like Kunti Devi is making here, that I wish those calamities would happen again and again. She's actually wishing for calamities. And who does that? Nobody does that. But she's wishing for them because she knows Krishna will be there in calamities. And so that brings me to a very important key principle here, that the darker is the night, the closer is Krishna's hand. Wherever we are, whatever is happening, the darker the night, the closer is Krishna's hand. We just have to recognize that. And in that way, the calamity is a tool to bring us into a deeper connection with Krishna. If we reach out to Krishna, then we recognize that Krishna is real and he can help us. And sometimes there's nothing we can do to help ourselves. We are unable to affect our deliverance. There are many calamities where we, at least we understand what kind of measures to undertake to avoid the calamity. And there's no harm in doing that, provided we understand that it will be by Krishna's mercy that our measures to avoid calamity will be successful. However, there always comes a point where we're beyond any kind of material help, that nothing we can think of, nothing we can do, nothing we can say will free us from the calamity that's at our doorstep. So in such a case, there's only one thing left, and that is to take shelter of Krishna. Actually, that's part of that whole story about Draupadi, that when Dushasana, he tried to rip Draupadi's sari from her. At first, she held on. And of course, Dushasana is a powerful man and Draupadi's a lady, so she was losing the battle of holding on to her sari while Dushasana was pulling on it. So finally she threw up her arms and asked Krishna to help. And then Krishna was later there, and Draupadi asked him why he waited to help her. And he said, "I was waiting until you asked me that." For a while you were trying to save yourself, and when you threw up your hands to me, and then I stepped in. So Krishna is waiting for us to turn to him, and that's the real purpose behind us being placed into calamities. And we will find we don't have to actually ask for calamities. There'll be plenty of them sent our way. So usually there's no shortage of calamities in the material world. But we can recognize that one of the functions of calamities is to actually make us focus on Krishna much more deeply. So let's see if there's anything else that Prabhupada mentions in this purport that I would care to focus on a little bit more. All right, that's it. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. Wonderful class, as always. So, Maharaj, you were saying that we, Kunti Devi was praying that we need to get more and more distressed so that we can see you again and again. Mm-hmm. And also as we always get distress, and then some people get attracted to Krishna, some people don't get attracted to Krishna. So that we, is it the soul which is going through all this pain, distress, and happiness and attraction, or is it the mind that's helping the soul to get to know Krishna and get attracted? Who's that we? Is that the soul?
It's definitely the soul.
Or is it so for some people it's the mind deviating them away from Krishna. It's not giving them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's all a function. We have the false ego, that magical thing that makes us believe that we are this body and makes us believe that we own not only this body, but all those things that are identified with the body, like our family, our house, our properties, our bank account, etc., etc. We believe that these things are somehow connected to us, but in fact, it's all a fiction. We are individual living entities. We come from the spiritual world. We don't remember what our relationship is with the Supreme. And instead, we're falsely identifying with this whole vast panorama of material effects. And it's all happening by the mercy of Ahankara, the false ego. The false ego allows us to identify with the body. And so calamities can only mean one thing. And they mean that one of those aspects of our material identification is being threatened. Our body, our family, our situation, our bank account, our household items, whatever you want to say, you know. So one of those things is coming into jeopardy. And as a result of that, we feel disturbance. But someone who does not identify with the body, nor all the effects that are associated with the body, such a person, what kind of calamity could there be for them? It's as if when we go to a movie, you know, we see somebody acting in some kind of role, and there may be some kind of danger, and, you know, we get apprehensive a little bit because we identify with the character in the movie. But ultimately, even if the character dies in the movie, we realize it's a movie. But this movie, the 80, 90, 100-year movie that we're in, we don't think the same way about it. We identify with the character. And we, to the extent that we are identified with the material body, to the extent that we are still in material consciousness identifying with our material desires, to that exact extent we suffer when calamities or adversity come. To the extent we're detached from it, to the extent we don't identify with the body, to that very extent also, calamities are kind of not really important, and they certainly don't cause us to suffer. So that's why we get this indication that when a person is actually advanced in devotional life, they don't take what other people would consider a great misfortune. They don't take it very seriously. And they don't even feel that much put upon when the body is in physical suffering, because they don't identify with it. Of course, again, these are very high stages of devotional realization. And they can be reached, though, by the gradual process of sadhana bhakti. We are performing everyday sadhana. We are chanting Krishna's name. We are hearing about Krishna. We are serving Krishna in various ways. We are trying to use the facilities given to us by our own karma. We have some kind of work, and we have some kind of past historic karma as well. The effects of both of those things are coming to us, our present work, our recent work, and our historic karma as well. And if we keep utilizing both of those facilities in Krishna's service, then we come more and more to understand that this is like a big computer game, that this material world appears to be real, but actually it's not. We appear to have a body, but actually the body is not us. We have family members, but actually they're other spirit souls who are on a journey, who happen to have come into the material world in proximity to our bodies. And the relationships that we deal with, we have responsibilities in the virtual world according to those relationships, but ultimately all those relationships are fictitious. That at the end of the lifetime, at that point, we'll realize that who is my father, who is my son, who is my child, who is... They were all other people on a journey through many lifetimes like us, who happen to be thrown together with us in this particular setting. And we call them by kinsmen and friends and relations, but actually they are simply other people who are also on the journey of many lifetimes. And that is the real situation. So calamities only hurt or sting from the perspective of heavy identification with all these upadis or designations. You know, we have, we designate ourselves as this, that, the other thing. We designate this is mine and that is for others. But all these things are not really that way. So again, it's a relationship of proportion, that to the greater degree that we are free from this mentality, to that same degree we'll be freed from the sense of suffering that calamities cause, or the fear that they cause us. I hope that makes sense.
Maharaj, I have two quick questions. Mm-hmm. They're When you say we have to always think of Krishna, does it have to be only Krishna? Or if you think of Prabhupada, if you think of a Guru Maharaj, that is also
Also connected. So, you know, what's that verse? That's the one where we hear that that's, I think, also Lord Shiva speaking, like, what is it? There's a verse that says that one that one that thinking of Vishnu is the highest thing, but higher than thinking of Vishnu is thinking of the things associated with Vishnu, namely the devotees. So we can think of Krishna directly, or we can think of Krishna's devotees, or for that matter, anything in relationship with Krishna, and it's non-different.
So it has the exact same effect.
It has the same exact effect. So if we're thinking about our devotional service, that is thinking of Krishna. If we're thinking of Krishna's pastime, that, of course, is thinking of Krishna. If we're thinking about Krishna's philosophy, that is thinking of Krishna. If we're carrying out some service for Krishna, and we're trying to understand how to carry that service out more carefully, so that it'll be more nicely done, then that's also thinking of Krishna. If we're thinking about Krishna's devotees, certainly that's thinking of Krishna. So there's no difference.
And also, even though when we get calamities, say for example, our children, we do have a responsibility. We can't say, "I'm not my body. You're not really my child. I don't have to help you." So how do you act in that
spirit? So we're not. Everybody has ordinary responsibilities as a part of their, you know, situation in the material world. But there's always reaches a point where you've done everything and there's nothing else to do. And that point is where you take shelter of Krishna. That's why Krishna doesn't tell us not to fight the battle of Kurukshetra, but he says at a certain point you do what you can and then you depend on Krishna. So that's actually the correct understanding, that we carry out our duties as far as we can, knowing that only if Krishna allows it will those duties be successful in bringing the result that we hope they will. But beyond a certain point, you know, sometimes we're clearly out of our league, that something comes upon us and there's not anything we can do, you know. So at that point we turn to Krishna. And that doesn't absolve us from our ordinary duties. There are responsibilities, you know, in family life, there are responsibilities at being a citizen in a country, there are responsibilities for being a employee of a particular, you know, organization. There are responsibilities to ISKCON, there are responsibilities to so many things. And in general, we take those and try to resolve those responsibilities. But we always recognize our primary responsibility is to always remember Krishna. Our primary responsibility is to become Krishna conscious. That's our primary responsibility. And then as much as possible, we try to navigate our other responsibilities. And if we do that, then there's no difficulty. We've done what we can. We don't pretend that our other responsibilities don't exist. We don't. We aren't remiss by ignoring them. But at the same time, we realize that it's only Krishna who allows us to be able to carry out our other responsibilities properly. So I hope that answers.
Yes, thank you very much.
Maharaj, you mentioned about the Veena.
Yeah.
So I don't know the story.
You don't know about King Veena? That's also in Bhagavatam. I'm trying to think where that is. That's in Prithu. I think that's fourth or fifth canto. Third or fourth canto, I think it is. There's a story that Maharaj Veena was a very materialistic and demoniac king. And his father was actually a pious king, and he tried to correct Veena, you know, but Veena was completely, you know, incorrigible. He didn't respond to any of the good counsel of his father. And later, when Veena became ruler, he ruled in a very ruthless and materialistic way. And the brahmanas were seeing that people were suffering. So they came and they confronted King Veena. And they told him that you can't do the things you're doing. That it's sinful according to the Vedas. And so Veena completely ignored them and insulted them. So the brahmanas, then they got together and they uttered the Sanskrit word hum, and Veena dropped dead. So they knew something had to be done. And they knew that Veena was actually not making the situation on the earth better by his rule. He was degrading people. So he was not willing to listen to them. And so with their Brahma Tejas, they simply killed him. And when he died, then they thought, well, now that he's dead, what do we do about a king? So then it's said that they churned his thighs some way or another. I don't know what that phrase actually indicates, but that's the way it's said in Bhagavatam. And from him, eventually, we get Prithu and Archie, who are the kings who take over. And Prithu actually is emblematic of proper ruling, so that's a kind of another Reader's Digest version of it, but that's basically the short story of Maharaj Veena.
Thank you.
All right.
So Veena is the one that goes to hell?
Yeah, he goes to hell. Because he was arrogant and offensive to the brahmanas. And unfortunately, he didn't think about Krishna in any kind of way.
And even though Shishupala was directly offensive to Krishna because
right.
he was thinking of him all the time.
He was thinking of him all the time. I think, you know, Shishupala, the story for him was that he was born kind of deformed. He had,
hands.
He had four hands and three eyes or something strange like that. And he was very weird looking. And so his mother was always trying to see if someone would have the mystic potency to make him look attractive again, you know. And she learned from one of the sages that eventually she would meet someone very powerful that would be able to make her son look normal. But that same person who would make her son normal would also later kill him. And so when different members of the royal order would come to their home, the mother would place little Shishupal on their lap to see, you know, if this was the person that would actually cure him of his strange looks, you know. And nothing worked. And finally one day Krishna came. And so she placed Shishupal on Krishna's lap, and immediately his extra arms fell off and his middle eye disappeared and so on and so forth. And he became to look normal. So Shishupal's mother prayed. She said, I've heard the prophecy that my son would be made attractive by someone very powerful, but then that someone very powerful would then later kill him. So she said, maybe he will be very insulting. So please don't take anything he says seriously. Don't take any insult he says to heart. And Krishna says, don't worry, I will not worry even about 1,000 insults. So, of course, Shishupal was constantly insulting Krishna. And I've heard it said, I don't remember the story completely because I haven't read it recently, but some say that it was, he had to say all those insults in the same time, so that with the Rajasuya sacrifice that Yudhishthira was planning to do, then at that sacrifice there was the idea of who would get the first worship, and it was put forward that Krishna should be worshipped first, and Shishupal just couldn't tolerate that. So he started to blaspheme Krishna back and forth, and that's when, you know, Krishna was counting it off, and finally, you know, Shishupal went over the mark, and all the kings there at the assembly of the Rajasuya sacrifice were preparing to kill Shishupal themselves, but Krishna said no. And then he sent his Sudarshan Chakra that lopped off the head of Shishupal, and then, as we heard, the soul from Shishupal's dead, lifeless body now came out, and it entered into Krishna's form. And that's when, you know, the question becomes, you know, why Shishupal? Why did he get that benediction? And then we find out that it was because he was always thinking about Krishna, but, of course, in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada reminds us, of course, that naturally we should not try to think about Krishna in a adverse way. You know, we should think of Krishna in a favorable way. But even if one does think about Krishna in an adverse way, one becomes purified by that thinking.
Even Sisupal and Krishna, they were cousins.
Yeah, they were related somehow. Yeah.
And still he could not tolerate in the assembly.
Well, that's the whole reason. We come here to the material world because we want to rub Krishna's name out of the center of everything and put our own name there. And so it's like, you know, the picture of Krishna and all the gopis and all the whole universe around him, we want to cut Krishna's picture out, and then we want to try to paste our picture in there. And it doesn't work. But we try to do it anyway. So that's why when we come to the material world, we have our own individual God project, each one of us. We're attempting to prove to ourselves and to everybody else that we actually are whatever it is that Krishna is. We are the most attractive, the most intelligent, the most wealthy, the most powerful, the most happy, the most famous. And when we see someone more famous, more attractive, more wealthy, we immediately become envious. And what to speak of Krishna himself, who's definitely more in all those categories. So that's why Shishupal could not tolerate it at all. And he kept maligning Krishna over and over again in all kinds of different ways.
So Maharaj, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda Prabhu came here, even if even for the fallen souls, Nityananda Prabhu would go and help them and then ask Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to forgive them, like Jagai and Madai. And then he would always go out and then introduce the name of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to all these fallen people. And I understand the avatar of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Nityananda, so merciful. So, and Nityananda Prabhu is none other than Balaram. So did he express similar potency or like this in when Krishna and Balaram came? Did he try to help any of these demons or anybody?
I don't know about that. I can't think of anything that I've read offhand right away that seems to indicate anything like that. But possibly, you know, I don't have anything to say as far as that goes. All right, I think we should end because I need to chant some japa and get cleaned up and all that good stuff. You know.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.